Drupal Voices is short daily podcast interviews with people doing work in the Drupal community. Brought to you by Lullabot, with Drupal workshops coming up in Portland, Oregon, and Providence, Rhode Island. For more information, go to lullabot.com/training.
My name is Becca Scollin. I'm a master's student at the University of Baltimore in their Interaction Design and Information Architecture program. And this past week, we conducted the third usability study for Drupal at the UB Usability Lab, which kind of started out once the Knight Foundation money was being talked about. I offered up the lab as a free place to potentially do a study before DrupalCon because I have access to it for free. And that's pretty awesome.
And so tell me a little bit about what you would do. You'd bring these people in and you'd watch them use Drupal for 90 minutes. And what were you looking for?
Well, this time around, I was really interested in bringing in some actual Drupal users to test because I've been interviewing Drupal users over the past few months. And one thing I'm really interested in is seeing how people who are used to using Drupal at least a little bit approach Drupal and use it. I mean, a lot of times people use software, but they use it in different ways and in interesting ways. They might have strange workarounds or, you know, new like ways they use the software that could probably be improved, make their own lives easier, and make Drupal easier for them to use. So I really kind of advocated for looking at a couple of those types of users. So in this case, we just created a test plan, just trying to create a situation that anyone might run into if they were developing a website. So, you know, someone you know, or you get a new job to build this site and they want Drupal. So, okay, this is what they want. They want this information up on their site. They want a navigation system that looks like this, you know, just really basic kinds of jobs. And then for the Drupal users, you know, we actually just tried to make it a little bit harder just to see how they'd approach things and introduce things that, you know, are important to a lot of people, like having search on their site and, you know, being notified about things when things happen on their site, and just see, you know, was this something that they had done before? Is this something that came easily for them? You know, what problems did they face? What ways, you know, were they used to working with in Drupal?
You did testing with 11 people, and some people with math background would say, oh, that's not a significant sample. And so how can you sort of extrapolate these 11 people and their experiences and sort of pick out the patterns?
Mm-hmm. Well, this time around, we were adding to a body of data of new users, and we did a very similar test to the one I did in my sessions last spring. So, I mean, I would say that we've actually built up a good number of new user data, and you are right, we do need to look at more intermediate users and test them more extensively. But the biggest thing about that is that, I mean, usability testing can be science. But if you're using it in the real world, oftentimes you really don't want it to be science. You don't want to have to test 35 people. It's a lot of money. It's not necessarily practical. A lot of the times you can get the same kind of answers once you've gotten 8 to 10 users. And so spending all that money and investing all that time isn't necessarily worthwhile. And the kind of interaction design process, which involves, you know, a lot of user research and evaluation with users, it's a cross between the arts and the sciences. It's not statistics. It's, you know, we're not trying to find statistically relevant data. You know, we're just trying to improve the design. And seeing users work with it will really help to improve the design because it kind of points you in the right direction. But, you know, scientific data right now isn't going to really help Drupal, you know.
It seems like the first usability test, they would sort of lock them in a room and give them a script and they would be on their own more or less. But in this case, you're sort of guiding them and making requests. And so talk a little bit about, like, the differences between them and, like, how can you keep from, like, feel like you're helping them along too much?
Mm-hmm. I guess the way I was trained, that just comes with practice. I mean, you oftentimes we'll talk to them just because you want to be able to get them to talk out loud about what they're experiencing while the test is going on. Because even if you have the eye tracking and you have the footage of what they're doing and you see that they're struggling, you don't necessarily know what they're thinking or why they're making certain choices. So communicating with the participant throughout the session kind of allows you to get a better sense of what they're expecting, what they're trying to do, which is really important when you're doing design. You want to know what people want to do and what they were expecting. They're like, oh, well, normally it works this way. You know, we learn that they have certain expectations about things, and that's really important to consider when you're designing something new or redesigning something. So there are much more formal methods for testing, and it is more typical for someone to have a task to do and to do it on their own in a room alone. So, I mean, that has its advantages, but you also can learn quite a lot if you talk to a participant during the session. And oftentimes, I wasn't where I was giving them tasks to do, which, you know, would, as probably, I'm assuming, which was on the paper with the participant in their first study, I wouldn't tell them what to do. You know, once I offered them a task, I would let them work on it for a while. And then after a couple minutes, we realize, okay, there's a problem. Let's talk to them about it. And then if they're still struggling, you kind of want to move on to the next task. So helping them out kind of helps you get through everything too and take better advantage of time, because you've only got so much time with that participant and you want to use it well.
What were some of the larger patterns that you were seeing over the course of the week of the people's behaviors in using Drupal?
Mm-hmm. Well, for the new users, we definitely confirmed a lot of similar patterns. One thing I thought was interesting with the new users, in my first study, a lot of people kind of latched on, or at least, you know, I definitely am wanting to go back and watch those tapes now. But a lot of people latched on to the create content link, as this is the one thing that, without expanding the navigation menu, that I can recognize and feel like I can get something done. And they would kind of go to it, and then they would do something, and then they would go back to it to, like, find their content. But it wasn't there. And, you know, it would take them a while to actually look under administer. But this time around, we actually, and I think it might have been just the types of users we recruited in that they were a little bit more sophisticated. They had more knowledge of maybe more contemporary CMSs. The last time I had people who use CMSs, but a lot of them were like enterprise or homegrown CMSs. This time, a lot of people actually kind of went towards administer and expected a lot of content to be under there that was offered in create content. So that was kind of interesting. And to me, that just means, okay, there's different types of users. They expect it in different places. You should really offer it in both places, you know, to get all of your grounds covered. So that was definitely just a little thing that was interesting to me, to see these two different expectations. Another big theme that we talked about through the testing that I thought was pretty important was it seemed like a lot of people just in, it seems like a lot of things you can do in Drupal are kind of siloed. So you go to one place to create a menu, but maybe that menu ties into your content and, you know, you expect maybe things to be linked together, or at least some of our participants did, but you kind of have to go to various screens to get that information and move kind of throughout. And then if you're not familiar yet with the lingo, you don't necessarily know where to go to find that other thing to enable or that other permission you have to set up. So that was definitely came up in a lot of our conversations, is kind of providing those what next steps, kind of helping people with their workflow. It's also kind of dangerous because you don't want to offer everything because people, you know, are all trying to do different things. But having a better sense of what people are trying to accomplish when they go into various parts of the administer page and kind of helping make those connections between the different areas they might have to go to do whatever they're trying to accomplish did seem like something that could be improved, because it seemed important to people. It's like, where do I go next? I really want to get this done, but I don't really know where to go.
And so there's a whole website, the DrupalUsability.org, that there's going to be all this information there, and the videos will be available at some point in the future. And so when people are watching these videos and seeing the eye tracking, what kind of things were you looking for, and what kind of patterns were you seeing, and what kind of cues were you taking from that eye tracking data?
Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, the eye tracking is just kind of helpful to see where people are focusing and looking on the page. So, like in the last study, a lot of people would miss the main navigation links that would get put up in Garland, and it wasn't a place their eyes would even approach after a couple minutes. And you would see their eyes kind of glance at it very quickly, but they hadn't actually seen it, because usually, you know, you can sense that people are looking around, but it's not necessarily registering in their head. So the eye tracking really just kind of helped to see, like, where people were used to looking. It's like, when they're trying to find something, like, are they actually reading the content on the administer page? Are they really focusing in on the left nav? Like, where are they going? What are they trying to do? And you can just kind of get a sense of where they might want to find something, whether it's there or not. You know, especially in one of the first clips, we show someone really looking to find create content under administer. And he looks at the left nav over and over again, but he's looking under administer. You know, he doesn't actually just take that glance above for a while to the create content link, you know, until after he's like really been working for like, I think it was like 3 minutes, which is a long time when you're, you know, just trying to like post an article and find the link to do that. So it just kind of helps you see where people are problem solving. I mean, there's definitely a lot more sophisticated stuff you can do with eye tracking, but I mean, one of the standard ways to use it is just to kind of see how people problem solve on a page, or if they're noticing, you know, your ad or something like that. So,
one thing that you said was interesting, that you and Bohan, another sort of usability student, were in a room full of Drupal developers, and you found it hard to talk about the problems without them wanting to go ahead and just immediately fix it. Can you just talk about what you meant by that, and what you said exactly?
Well, I was talking about how, yeah, Bojan and I would be in the room, and we had just watched a session, and everyone would, you know, there would definitely be some major issues that had popped up during the session, and the conversation immediately turned to the various patches or various fixes that they had seen or maybe wanted to see. And it was just really, you know, people were really excited. You know, you see users do things a certain way and you want to fix it. You want to make it better. Or maybe you've seen like the perfect patch out there that, you know, people want to, you know, we want to, you know, use it. You want to like use this as proof that this is what's going to work. And it was definitely difficult to get people to focus solely on the issues. And like, I guess what I was talking about was just that, you know, when you do these tests, even though we're not using as many users, like maybe we're only using 8 to 10, it's really only once you get to 8 to 10 that you can start to see the patterns emerge. So on the first test, like, of course there are going to be some issues that come up, but, you know, maybe no one else will encounter that same problem, or maybe everyone will. You don't really know. Or you may find someone who has the same problem, but in a completely different way. And so maybe this solution that you're kind of fantasizing about after that first time wouldn't work for the next person. So it really helps to sit back and just let it happen, you know, and let patterns emerge, let different themes come up, and then focus on solutions. You don't want to jump to any conclusions immediately when you're doing this kind of testing. You want to let it kind of pan out and let all of that experience and all of that information afterwards inform your design solutions. So
what advice would you give to the Drupal community and with regards to usability?
Well, definitely making user testing more of a part of the process. I really kind of liked the idea of testing kind of being considered, what was that? Just like you test code, you want to test the interface too. I mean, it's important to come up with, I think, different ways the community can approach it in an affordable way, just because labs are so expensive and usability experts tend to be really expensive. But coming up with some of the more, I guess they're usually called like the different guerrilla tactics. There's all kinds of remote testing that can be done. There's all kinds of ways that everyone can take a look at different interfaces and, you know, get new users or even intermediate users to test out modules or to test out different things in core and just see how they approach them. I mean, one of the big things in moderating such interviews is really kind of keeping yourself from leading that person or trying to like not use words in the interface, trying not to give them a sense of what they have to do to get the job done. So there is that kind of danger there, and you can really kind of skew an interview towards what you want. So teaching people how to do this kind of testing and moderating is important. And also, it's probably best practice for, you know, if you create something yourself, you shouldn't test it yourself. You're only going to see what you want to see, you know, and it's very likely that you'll lead someone to do what you want them to do. But even just kind of creating ways for people to test each other's work and each other's interfaces, getting more designers and interaction designers to review work and discuss it and having a bigger role in that will definitely help it. And just coming up, you know, making some decisions, you know, deciding a couple things, putting them in place, and then testing them again. Now, that's the big thing. Retesting, just making a culture around the user and how they use it. So.
Great. Well, thanks.
You're welcome.